Welcome to Founders Unfiltered by a Junior VC. We are your hosts, Aviral and Mazen. Mazen, I think you spent some time in Indonesia, right? Any peculiarities that you saw there? Have you seen people around on bikes? Have you actually seen this company called Gojek?
Yeah, so I've been to Indonesia a few times over the years. And the first time I went there, I immediately noticed that there was a lot of traffic and there were a lot of bikes. And then when I went back last year, I could see the Gojek bikes everywhere. I mean, they had these distinct green jackets and helmets. I had no idea what Gojek was at the time, but just seeing these bikes go by, how convenient and easy they were, you know, it kind of prompted me to download the app and use it to get around. And it made such a big difference in the traffic, you know, getting a ride on a bike. It was amazing. In this episode, we talked to Kevin, who is one of the co-founders of Gojek, about how he built Indonesia's first Decacon. Kevin started his career in investment banking, but he moved back to Indonesia, where he actually worked as the head of business intelligence for an e-retailer called Zalora, which was founded by Rocket Internet. And that's where he met his co-founder, Nadim. Nadim started working on Gojek part-time as a side project and launched the company in 2010.
The name Gojek comes from, you know, the motorbikes that you were talking about. They're called Gojeks, right?
Yes.
In Indonesia. And it's a wonderful name, very evocative. As you were rightly saying, they were solving a very acute problem that everyone was dealing with. You know, it wasn't like there wasn't enough taxi drivers. There were taxi drivers. And Gojek basically matched demand and supply. Kevin was initially the CFO of the company. But as the company grew, his role evolved and actually changed. And he talks about that in our conversation. At one point of time, Gojek was growing 100% month on month, insane, for like 12 months. And Kevin really shared with us very candidly how he had to reinvent himself. In late 2019, Kevin, along with Gojek Group's president, was promoted to be the co-CEO. Please enjoy our conversation with Kevin. It's an incredible entrepreneurial journey, and we learned a lot through our conversation with him. Hey, Kevin, thank you so much for taking our time to speak to us. This really means a lot. And I think we're really looking forward to understanding how you've actually built Gojek from scratch. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Happy to be here, Aviral.
So, Kevin, we want to start with your journey and background a little bit. How did you decide to start Gojek, and what really motivated you to leave a very promising career in finance to start Gojek? You know, 5-6 years back.
So my co-founder, Nadim, who today is the Minister of Education and Culture in Indonesia, you know, we've been friends for probably about 15 plus years as of now. We've always wanted to start something together since our first professional experience. So even though we've been friends for a while, we finally had an opportunity to work together at Rocket Internet, at Zalora, which was their fashion e-commerce site that launched in 2011 in Indonesia. And so we were part of the early team, the founding team for that business here in Indonesia. During that time, you know, we struck a very good professional relationship, and you know, we were always talking about, you know, what are the interesting opportunities and what were the challenging problems in Indonesia that could potentially be something we could get our hands dirty with. And so, you know, through many of these conversations, we finally landed on Gojek, which is actually something that he originally founded you know, a few years back when we started talking about it. But it was never a full-time setup for him and the other co-founders, and so, you know, when we decided to jump into it full time, we raised a small venture round at the time. It was $2 million in 2014, I guess the rest is history. We can talk a little bit more about, you know, what happened between, you know, that first funding round and today, but that's kind of how we got there. But, you know, from a personal standpoint, I always knew that starting a company is what I wanted to do. I've always seen every job that I've had as a stepping stone on this journey. And I, to be very honest, I can't see myself doing anything else but helping start a company together with great people.
Would love to understand a little bit more about the Indonesian ecosystem in general and the pain point that you actually saw. How did you realize that this is a way to, you know, really build a compelling business? And related to that, I think, you know, you've built a very big team in India. If you could talk about these two ecosystems a little bit, which will set the context for our topic, which is building for scale. Would love to understand that, and then we can deep dive into the journey that you had from that seed round onwards.
Sure. I think from an ecosystem perspective, I can probably speak a lot more authoritatively about the Indonesian ecosystem than I can the Indian. I know a fair bit about the Indian ecosystem, but I'm sure your listeners will know far more than I would. But in Indonesia, in 2011, so I lived in the States for a while. I went to college in the U.S. and I worked in the U.S. for a little bit before coming back to Indonesia in 2011. In 2011, the ecosystem was basically a wasteland. I say that with, you know, the utmost respect for the people who are working in the industry since then, which includes myself. But I think at the time, there was still a lack of a critical mass for the ecosystem to really exist. And a few of those things were, for example, user behavior primarily at the time still saw the internet as a place to consume content. So what that meant was, you know, the dominant internet properties and companies were ones that were selling essentially eyeballs. So these were like news portals, forums, and various other primarily text-based content sites. And this was to the detriment of really, you know, where a lot of the value of, you know, where the internet actually empowers today, which is transactional. So at the time, you know, the in 2011, when I first started working in this industry, it was very much all ads based, no transactions. And because of the small, relatively speaking, size of this industry, you didn't really get the best talent. I guess one way of thinking about it is, you know, the business talent, the people who are interested in being in this space were people who were really passionate about the space, not necessarily. And that meant that the bench of talent that was available was fairly thin. So, you know, you wouldn't have people from, you know, fantastic business backgrounds necessarily seeing this as the top industry of choice to be in. And that made sense given how small the industry was. And then on the technical side, you know, the idea of taking a computer science major and working for a startup building these companies was not something that was attractive. You know, for most people who were majoring in computer science and other kind of engineering fields, their best bet would be, you know, working for either like a management consulting firm or an oil company, or, you know, kind of get into a big company's IT department and hopefully move your way up to become a manager somehow. And so, you know, the critical mass to kind of like really support this industry, which is, you know, great business talent, great technical talent, and a lot of investor interest didn't really exist back then. And actually, you know, I would credit, at least in Southeast Asia, Rocket Internet as, you know, one of the companies that really kind of jumpstarted that, because they started spending a lot of money in customer acquisition, building that awareness that you can transact online, at the internet wasn't just a place for you to consume content, but also paying very high salaries for people who would join their companies. So you kind of got that interest of mostly business, because at the time their technical teams were centralized in Berlin. But I think that was the kind of like the was really one of the key moments in the Indonesian ecosystem to really kind of jumpstart the industry. And that kind of happened in 2011, 2012. Which is around the time, you know, Nadeem and I started working together. And so, you know, bringing it to, you know, how we ended up with Indian engineering centers is because, you know, that anecdote about how computer science and software engineering isn't wasn't really seen as like a hot thing for a bright student to be studying. It also means that, you know, we don't have a long history of top engineering talent. Because, you know, even if you were a great software engineer, you wouldn't end in, and you've had, you know, let's say you graduated college in like the 90s or the early 2000s, by the, you know, 2010s and 2011s, if you were really great and you were really ambitious, you probably wouldn't be a software engineer anymore at the time. And so, you know, that lack of, you know, technical talent meant that, you know, to really grow a company of our scale, we would have to look outside the country. And it's not because there aren't really intelligent, bright people. It's just there wasn't the culture and there wasn't the opportunity to experience what it's like to build a software company at scale that was available in Indonesia. So there just wasn't that experience. Whereas from what I understand about the Indian ecosystem, it kind of started in with these like outsourcing centers. And at least there was that kind of nexus that then became this very vibrant technology ecosystem. And so how we ended up with an engineering center in India, in Bangalore specifically, was that, you know, we raised money from Sequoia Capital India in sometime April, May 2015. And at the time, the company was scaling incredibly. I think we average north of 100% month-on-month growth rate for like 12 straight months. And, you know, at that time, you know, we were really struggling with scaling our backend. There was just a ton of crashes, a ton of very random disastrous bugs happening left and right. And we were really struggling to keep up with the demand. And so we were introduced by our board member, Shalindra, to these companies based in India who would help some of the earlier stage Sequoia portfolio companies when they ran into issues similar to ours. And so, you know, they came in and they essentially rewrote our entire backend within a couple of weeks. And suddenly, you know, our system scaled, you know, not without hiccups, but definitely much better than it did previously. And, you know, we found this cultural fit with the founders and the leadership teams of these software houses. And we struck a very good, I guess, bond at that time we were working together that we decided to acquire their companies. And so from that acquisition, you know, the Gojek Bangalore office was born.
That really is a great segue into, you know, building for scale. It seems like the Indian teams came in at the right time, and I think they become integral to the company. I'll hand it off to Mazen now, where he'll talk about a topic which is hypergrowth and operating at scale.
Thanks, Abhiral. So having experienced an incredible amount of hypergrowth in a really compressed time frame, we believe you have a unique perspective on what it means to scale. And I think what you've accomplished is something that a lot of founders dream of. So let's start off by actually talking about some of the mistakes that you made and what you learned from them on your journey building Gojek.
I think there are literally countless mistakes, I think. Some big, some small. I think one thing that's actually really important, I wish I knew earlier, was around really the importance of people. You know, I think this is a little overstated. I don't think this is like the most groundbreaking insight. And I think actually, you know, if we take a step back, I also want to say that, you know, most things around, you know, lessons learned and best practices and all that, I do believe that most of these things are obvious. I think for you know, self-aware, smart, observant people, most of these things are obvious. And really what differentiates people is, you know, how obsessive or maniacal you want to take those principles. And so like this point around people, I think everyone knows that people are important. And everyone knows that, especially in a software company where your job is to convert, you know, thoughts into software, everyone knows that, you know, you have to be very people-centric. But really, how far do you want to take it? And so, you know, I think, you know, around people, there's just so many things that I could kind of take from this. I mean, a few of the highlights of things that, you know, I've personally been working on over the last, you know, 12 months is, you know, the importance of communicating a vision, a set of principles, and of managing based on vision and principles rather than through, I guess, orders. I think this is something that's really important as you scale, because it's really easy when you're a small company to kind of work with the entire team, make it very clear, through implicit and explicit communication, you know, what your vision is, how you want it done, and what are the principles by which you make decisions and you make trade-offs as a company. I think those things become very, those things are obvious when you're in a small company. But as you kind of grow to, you know, more and more layers, as you hire and recruit people with, you know, slightly different cultural leanings and things like that, these things start to break down. And you start seeing, you know, work quality that might, you know, not be up to your standards, initiatives or ways of operating that are not in line with how you see the company or its cultural values, or a lack of understanding of what exactly are we trying to achieve here. And I think, you know, I could spend, you know, easily like maybe a half hour this whole podcast just talking about this one thing around people. So just, you know, how you communicate a vision and manage through principles, I think is extremely important to make that transition as you scale, because you don't really have the ability to just have, you know, one-on-one chats and be always in the room where all the important decisions and discussions are happening for the whole company. So being able to make that transition of managing through vision and through principles, I think is one big learning that I still think I am learning today, but I wish I probably learned it sooner. I think when you have a business that's growing very rapidly, it's very easy to forget on really what's important. I think when the business is growing, investors are interested in meeting with you. It's very easy to fall into the trap that, you know, you can conquer the universe and you can do everything, and you forget that really, you know, what has driven, you know, your business to scale is basically only two things: brand and product. If your brand is great and your product is great, everything else will kind of take care of itself when it comes to growing. But I think, you know, when you're on a rocket ship, and I know that, you know, not all startups are blessed with the, you know, being fortunate enough to be on a rocket ship, but when you are on a rocket ship, it becomes like, hey, you know, business is growing really quickly, everything is great, investors are coming in, let me launch these like five other things, let's try to do, you know, way more things. And you kind of forget that, you know, the very first reason why your business is a rocket ship to begin with is because you have a great product and you have a great brand. And that's actually something that you need to continue to invest in and be conscious and not kind of, you know, fall into your own hype in a way. And that's why you kind of have to continue to be maniacal in really building the best product and the best user experience and really creating a brand that people love. So if I had to say my second probably big learning here is really kind of be laser focused on these fundamentals and make sure that they're very sound and continue to improve as you scale. Because it's these things very quickly erode as you scale unless you pay attention to them. And maybe finally, usually people like to have, like, you know, learnings in threes, right? I usually only have twos, but if I have to think about, you know, a third one, it sounds counter to the first point, but I think the third point is really that I think you have to be really mindful about, you know, which people are good at which stage of the company. And this has to include yourself, right? You know, I think the way that you apply it to yourself is that you have to be conscious. And I'm just going to apply it to myself because I think, you know, talking about other people when it comes to this probably sounds insensitive. You have to be very aware of what skill sets and abilities that you have and what you can develop and be conscious about what that development is, but also realize that, you know, at some point, the things that you bring to the table might no longer be what's needed by the company if you're kind of scaling very quickly. And so what that means is, you know, you have to hire to fill those positions. And also you need to continue finding areas where you can continue to be providing value or where you are uniquely positioned to kind of provide value. And I'll give you a very specific example here where, you know, I used to be the CFO of Gojek. And very quickly, you know, when we started raising, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, what was required for that job very quickly outstripped my capabilities. And I had to be conscious of that. And I should have, you know, as a co-founder, I shouldn't be married towards this identity that I have of, oh, I'm the CFO. This is my job. This is why I'm here. This is why I'm valued. Rather, I should actually head towards a mind space where I know, like, hey, I'm out of my depth here. And we need to find better people in order to do this because that's what the company needs. And I need to learn new skills and figure out other things where I can be useful in order for me to deserve my spot here in the company. The objective here ultimately, right, is to build a company that is enduring and outlasts any individual. For example, I think one company I like to think about a lot is Nike, where, you know, most people don't know Phil Knight is the founder of Nike, but everyone knows Nike, everyone knows their products, everyone knows what their brand stands for, even though, you know, no one really knows who the founder is. And I think that's what we should aspire to build, because it's really, and one of our Gojek's core values is actually literally, it's not about you. And we really kind of believe that. And I think that's one of the learnings that I would kind of have to take to, if I had to kind of advise my past self.
There's a lot more kind of known about that initial kind of phase when you're building a company, and a lot fewer people have been through this kind of rocket ship phase where you're really growing like crazy. You touched on some things, you know, people, that you need different types of people at different phases. Were there any other important factors to consider? Anything else that people should keep in mind when they get into that rapid growth phase?
This is one of those things where I really wish I could be a lot more useful when it comes to giving this type of advice. I think in all honesty, we were very lucky. The rocket ship wasn't necessarily built through very smart, you know, growth hacking and stuff like that. And yes, sure, you know, we had, you know, all these types of growth strategies, you know, referrals and, you know, very smart branding stuff and like the jackets and the helmets that were very unorthodox at the time. But I think the reason why I can't really offer a lot of advice when it comes to like, okay, how do you actually tune a rocket ship is because, you know, we found such an acute problem. Right. And the problem in Jakarta and in, I would say, all major Indonesian cities is that the relative underdevelopment of road infrastructure and public transportation relative to population growth means that your traffic is debilitating. It's absolutely terrible. And so, you know, we actually found an acute problem on the demand side, which is terrible traffic, which means, you know, people either spend too much time in traffic commuting or they have to go through traffic to do errands. On the demand side of the marketplace, there was this hugely acute problem. It was a very obvious problem that everyone dealt with no obvious solution. And on the supply side, on the driver side, and I think it's an important point to note that Gojek was originally founded as a social enterprise to empower the motorcycle taxi driver. And so we've always had a very keen eye for the supply side of this marketplace, and that started from the driver. And understanding that for a lot of these drivers, they were honest, hardworking people who simply had a hard time connecting with the demand that was actually available. And there was, I think, elements of formalizing it to make it, you know, safer, more official feeling, and just generally more professional. But, you know, with some of those minor tweaks, those drivers would be a perfect fit to solve that demand side of the problem. And so, and because, you know, on the demand side, the problem was so acute, and the supply side, the problem was also very acute, that like, hey, these are the livelihoods, right? These are men and women who are trying to earn money for their families, who don't have enough utilization and demand to reliably have that income on a daily basis. And so you take these very acute problems from a supply and demand perspective, and you put a marketplace in the middle. That's kind of how the rocket ship happened. I don't have tips necessarily on how to make your company a rocket ship, but I think thinking about, you know, how acute really is the problem for the people and the customers that you're serving, I think is really the critical piece, because, you know, no amount of, you know, fun, tricky growth hacking levers is really going to, you know, solve the problem if you're really not solving a really fundamental problem. That's kind of, you know, my perspective on this, because I don't think we necessarily did anything brilliant to kind of create that rocket ship outside of trying to tackle a very hard problem, a very acute problem, and a very big problem.
So for founders who are listening, if you found the right problem that is acute enough and you've built the right solution for it, that's what leads to building a rocket ship. There's no formula for it, which I think is a great insight. But you spoke about the differences between Indonesia and, you know, the Valley or other developed economies. Can you maybe elaborate a bit more on that?
First of all, I think that in many circles, there are these conversations around, you know, creating the next Silicon Valley. And I think, you know, I think that's folly. You know, there will not be another Silicon Valley. because Silicon Valley is a very special combination of things that are, you know, historical from the perspective of, you know, government investment in military related technology, proximity to great, you know, research universities, venture capital, you know, all of this stuff. Although there might be other type of technology hubs that might look and feel different. You know, if you kind of look at the Indonesian, I guess, ecosystem, we're probably, you know, out of all of the, you know, if you look at like a list of, you know, the most, and this is a poor proxy, but I'm going to use it anyway. But if you kind of look at, you know, the list of the highest valuation startup companies in the world, you'll actually see that there's in the top maybe 50 to 100, you'll see a few Indonesian companies. And I think this is pretty surprising. You know, I think no one will be surprised to obviously see American companies. No one will be surprised to see Chinese or Indian companies. But to see a few Indonesian companies, I think is pretty surprising. And I think, you know, it really speaks towards the value of, you know, this specific market. I mean, we are, after all, still the fourth largest country in the world by population. But also, it's very surprising because the supporting ecosystem of talent and to a lesser extent funding is actually a lot more nascent than other markets that you would see in this, you know, list of, you know, most valuable private tech companies. This is the reason why you see foreign venture capital firms often be very active in this space, because a lot of the locals, I think, you know, for many reasons, haven't really found the right strategy. But also the fact that, you know, the companies of our scale, you know, I don't want to say it's a secret. It's not a secret, but, you know, all the companies here who are of scale and many companies who are not even at our scale actually have Indian and Singapore engineering centers. And the reason is because, again, the scale of company, the size of the problem, size of the opportunity, companies that have kind of captured these opportunities and are starting to solve the problem have grown at a much more rapid pace than the availability of talent, especially technical talent. And so this is kind of a very interesting opportunity for founders. It's also a very interesting opportunity for, you know, engineers, product managers, data scientists, designers all across the world, in that, you know, you have this part of the world where there isn't a long history of these talents being deployed in companies like ours. And it's another interesting kind of, I guess, frontier as, you know, the world becomes more globalized when it comes to talent, to kind of, you know, pay attention to. And if I had to, you know, think about it, I think especially with what's happening here with coronavirus pandemic, as more and more companies move remote, I can see a world where, you know, a lot of Indonesian companies start getting more and more of their talent remotely, as you know, most people now are working from home, and I think it's an opportunity to not only build great companies, world class companies, but it's also an opportunity for these companies to find mentors, senior experienced people to mentor local talent, and really kind of be the seed of, you know, the future generation of companies, especially from a technical talent perspective.
Gojek has now become a super app. We all know that, and forayed into multiple use cases. Many companies, even some of the, you know, US tech giants have tried and failed to do this. What do you think was different for you guys as Gojek?
It was a combination of factors. You know, so the super app thing, people often talk about and talk about, you know, what the upsides are, and I think what the message that we always want to push, and I don't think we've done enough to push this message, is that specifically with Gojek, we didn't start as a super app. I mean, we didn't start calling ourselves a super app, even though the principles of, you know, what makes super apps great were always in our product philosophy from day one. So when we launched the app in January 2015, we had three different services: take a ride with a motorcycle taxi driver, get that motorcycle taxi driver to send a package, or get that motorcycle taxi driver to buy you something and bring it to you. So from day one, we had these three different services because we started from the driver's perspective. And the way we saw it was that, hey, traffic sucks. A human being on a motorcycle can do many things. So why don't we let that human being on a motorcycle do many things? And that's kind of, you know, how we approached it. And that's why, you know, there's this whole narrative now that that kind of gets wrapped around the company, around us being a super app. And I think the narrative is, you know, I would say to a large extent correct, but this is all we know, right? We've always viewed both the supply and demand side of our marketplace as your customers and people, and people are able to do many things or need many things done for them. So, you know, kind of having that, you know, customer-centric approach, both on the demand side and the supply side, I think is what's served us well. And now the supply side also includes, you know, restaurants and other merchants for payments and food delivery. But, you know, that philosophy has been fairly consistent. And I think there's also another angle to this, which is the fact that to my earlier point around how nascent the industry is, the fact of the matter is that there weren't many other companies doing other things, right? I think if you looked at, let's say, Uber in the U.S., you know, I think what they've tried to do with, you know, expanding into payments is very challenging, because there's a lot of other payments players, and I've heard, I don't know what the latest news is, but I know that, you know, they're probably scaling that back. And I think, you know, in Indonesia we don't have the same ecosystem maturity. And so we were more able to expand and experiment into other spaces. And in the spaces where we gained traction, we were able to reinvest and really grow our stake in that area. And I think that the second piece that I think is also probably a little bit more important and probably unique to us is that, you know, we were the first on-demand super app. You know, WeChat is kind of, you know, the more general purpose super app that started as chat. But for us, you know, we were the first on-demand service provider super app in the world. And the reason we were able to do that, and it was kind of unique to us, is because, you know, the same driver base, which is, you know, a motorcycle driver, can be used for many of those services. Maybe something that is more difficult for a car because just of its size and relative agility. But, you know, with a motorcycle taxi or a motorcycle driver, you're able to do so many different services. And as you kind of think about a daily economy of, you know, commuting in the morning, sending lunch during lunch hours, sending packages in the afternoon, bringing people home on their, you know, evening commute, and sending dinner. You know, you can kind of think about, you know, the utilization being nicely distributed and providing more income earning opportunities for these drivers when you kind of layer on multiple different services. So there's also that kind of unique, you know, situation in time where, you know, we have a lot of motorcycles and potentially a lot of different jobs that we can get our drivers to do. So that, I think that part is pretty unique for us. And maybe in this space, it's unique for us in Indonesia and to motorcycle taxi drivers. But I think, you know, for maybe other founders, you know, really think about, you know, building a super app, there needs to be some kind of thing that makes sense, you know, either on the demand and or supply side, that kind of links all of the different services you want to layer in together, rather than just thinking, hey, I'm going to add in a bunch of different things and it'll be a super app, a successful
one. I think that is a superb insight, in the sense that you basically help build infrastructure in a country that actually did not have that infrastructure in place. And I think this has to do with the very strong mission that Gojek as a company has. And I think you personally also deeply care about your drivers, the environment, uplifting society. Now, fast forward to the pandemic, the last 3-4 months have been super turbulent. How have those beliefs helped, or have they been challenged? And how have you adapted with this, you know, really important mission that you have as a company as well as personally?
Look, I think, you know, what's happened today is on the ground is something that deeply concerns us. A lot of the narrative that we see today in the technology industry, you know, talks about how business has been impacted and it's a challenging fundraising environment, and you know, everyone has to kind of revise what their outlook is for the business. And while that is all true and that is all difficult, I think a more important point, especially for marketplace businesses like ours, is that, you know, as an aggregator, we're a lot more resilient than any individual constituent of that marketplace. So when you look at individual drivers, when you look at individual merchants or restaurants, how this pandemic has impacted them, especially the worst hit, is far worse than us as a company. And so, you know, we've done a lot in terms of trying to share, you know, some of that resilience, you know, with them. But it is really challenging. And, you know, we do things like we've recently set up a foundation where the purpose of the foundation, at least, you know, for the foreseeable near term, is really to provide, you know, pandemic-related relief to our drivers. This is a foundation where, you know, all of Gojek's top management took a meaningful pay cut. We all took a 25% pay cut in order to provide funds for this foundation. And many of our employees also voluntarily participated into this fund. We've started working very closely with a lot of our restaurant partners and providing, you know, online events where they can kind of market their product. We've, you know, worked closely with, you know, a lot of these small mom and pop stores in order to help them take their business online. We've helped with some of our dark kitchens or cloud kitchen partners to, again, you know, take restaurants from, you know, what today is probably lower traffic areas with high rent to a more affordable setup where they can continue selling their products. And so when you kind of think about it, I think the hardest hit really are these individual members of our marketplace, and a lot of our efforts have really disproportionately been around making sure that, you know, they can survive this pandemic as we can. And I think, again, one of the best things about what we do is really that our growth is dependent on the growth of our partners, because our revenue is all, you know, from our commissions, from the growth and the business that we provide to them. I think we're very fortunate that this is one of those situations where, you know, a social mission and caring for the so-called little guy actually aligns with building a business that's of scale. And so I think we're very fortunate to kind of have that alignment. And that's why it's important, because, you know, it's not just philosophically the right thing to do, but it's also the right thing to do for our business.
Basically, this has reinforced your beliefs and mission. And I think that there's a lot of learning for people who are listening in, large company founders who are also listening. And this is, I think, something that definitely should be replicated. So we'd like to conclude with a question that we ask all the founders that we speak to. And that's why we call it Founders Unfiltered. What is that one piece of unfiltered feedback that you've received over your journey that you'd like to share with us, which really impacted you?
Can I say I love this question? And I actually asked this similar question to a lot of the leaders that I interview for a position at Gojek. Okay. So I love this question. And you know, for me, the harshest feedback is actually one that really hit hard on myself, my self-image, and the thing that I was proud of. And I'm very proud of being this objective person. Like, you know, I have this idea in my head that, you know, I always see things fairly from multiple different angles, and I will make an objective decision. And that's a big part of my identity and a big part of how I think that I bring value to the table. And I got this feedback, I think it's like 2-3 years ago, and it's still so fresh in my mind, because the feedback was from somebody that I work kind of closely with. And she said that, hey, you have your favorites, that when you have, when there's a specific conflict, like, and there's one person on one side and another person on the other, and you kind of have to referee, or you kind of have to figure out, you know, which is the right course of action, you will always choose, or more often than not, you will choose this person. And it's because you have your favorites, and you will see the people who are not on your favorites list as, you'll see them with more scrutiny, and you will give more of a pass for the people that you like. And, you know, this person was, I mean, I'm thankful that this person was very upfront and brutal about this. And I thought about it, you know, this person was right, that I do have my favorites, that I do set different bars for people depending on how much I like them. And we can spend more time, we can spend a lot of time talking about what makes me like one person over another. But, you know, I think suffice to say, I was far, 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 far from as objective as I thought I was. And I think spent the better part of the last 2 or 3 years really, you know, being very conscious of, you know, the people and thoughts and ideas that I have bias towards, and recognize that I have that bias, and try to kind of work against that if I really want to be objective.
Thank you for sharing that. It's wonderful advice. So Kevin, thank you so much for taking out time from your schedule to speak to us.
Now, a quick summary of what we discussed with Kevin, the co-founder of Gojek. Gojek was growing faster than anyone imagined.
they averaged north of 100% month-on-month growth rate for 12 months straight. When asked about how to create a rocket ship like Gojek, Kevin says there is no formula and not much advice that he can offer. They did use some smart growth hacking and branding techniques, but the real cause of their incredible growth is just that they found a solution to an acute problem that many people dealt with. It was that simple. As for his learnings throughout his journey with Gojek, Kevin had three. One, when you scale, it becomes really important to manage through a vision rather than through direct orders. Making that transition becomes so important as you can no longer be in the room where every decision is made. People have to just sort of know what to do. And he's still learning how to do this and wish he'd learned it sooner. Second, he says it's easy to get carried away and think you can conquer the world and do too many things. But you have to be laser focused on creating a great product and brand that people love. And three, there are different people who are good for the company at different stages. And he used himself as an example. As the CFO, once they started raising tens and hundreds of million dollars, it outstripped his capabilities and he was not the best fit for the role anymore. So as a co-founder, he had to be aware of this and find new ways where he could uniquely add value to the company. Regarding how Gojek built a super app that does everything, Kevin credits their customer-centric approach. From day one, they realized that a human on a bike could do many things. He says that because the ecosystem was more nascent than the US, it was easier to add services, like payments, for example. He also added that Gojek was the first on-demand super app. The reason they were able to do that and why it was unique to them is because motorcycle taxis could be used for many different purposes versus a car that's not as agile. Kevin and Gojek really care about their drivers. They're a mission-driven company. Given the recent challenges with COVID, Gojek as a company has done a lot to pass on the resilience that it has as a large company to its participants. For example, Gojek set up a foundation to provide relief to drivers, and top management actually took a 25% pay cut to provide funds to this foundation. There's a lot to learn from Gojek's story, but not a lot of it can be replicated. If you want to build a rocket ship, find a big problem and build an effective solution to that problem. Thank you so much for tuning in to Founders Unfiltered. I've got a favor to ask you. Will you take a minute to review us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening? Thank you.